And I started realizing if I did the polar opposite of everybody else, I got these monumental returns. If I did what everyone else was telling me to do, I got nothing.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for another exciting episode of Get Your Fill, Financial Independence and Long Life, where we find people who are experts in ways to achieve those two goals. And first of all, before I go any further, I want to remind you that this is an excellent time to share and to like this podcast, because you know that there's a friend of yours who wants to learn all the things that are exciting and just awesome fun. You know, I'm trying to find the right way to describe Miles Wakeham, but it's because he's a contrarian, like none of these little boxes fit him really well. So Miles, I'm so excited that you're here with us today to show us how to like turn all of our thoughts and ideas on their heads.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be with you.
So Miles, were you always a contrarian? I mean, kind of like bring us up to what was your early life like?
Yeah, I was. weird. I don't say this that often, but I was an adopted only child. So that makes me pretty unusual. But what's really weird is that I was one of those children that were taken from mothers in the early 1960s by the Catholic Church, who were not allowed, because they were too young, to rear a child. And I was wrenched out of my mother's arms and then put into a kind of a monastery and then put up for adoption. Of course, I didn't know any of that. I'm a baby, right?
Yeah, but that's a very, I'm sure, even though you might not remember any of it, that's got to be really, you know, mentally and emotionally upsetting.
I think, well, yeah, to some degree. I mean, I'm sure there are sort of emotional barriers to growth and things like that that come into it. But for me, what I ended up starting to inherit very early on was this sense of needing to be in control, like to make my own decisions, to wear the responsibility of that, but basically never defer my power to somebody else. And I think that's been the rails that my life has traveled upon all the way through.
Interesting. Yeah. And that's what we do, right? When we go to, we work for someone else, that they're in control, they say, right? I mean, you have to do this. Okay. Well, and right now, I mean, not to get political or anything, but, you know, people are like losing their jobs because they don't want to get vaccinated. You know, if you work for yourself, you don't have to make those kind of decisions. You don't have to change nobody gets to tell you, right, what happens.
Right.
How did that manifest itself as a young person?
Well, I did realize that, like every human being in our species, we need to socialize. So I couldn't stick myself in my own bedroom and live that solo life. Like, that wasn't me. I needed friends and all that stuff. So I was very active in that. But I also realized that my parents were wonderful in that they had wisdom, that they didn't give me things. I had to earn everything. And that meant, you know, at the age of like 10, I had a paper route, and then that wasn't good enough, so I had another one, and then that wasn't good enough, so I had a part-time job. And next thing you know, I'm working like 30 hours on top of school as a wow. kid. But I loved it. I mean, I loved the reward, you know, like that instant gratification. Do something, get paid. Oh, this is good. Let's exactly. do that again.
How the real world this works.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened was through years later, I discovered electronics and I got this real thirst for knowledge, and not hacking isn't the right word, but just to sort of test everything and to try and find a way forward, right? So early on, I guess it was about 14, 15, the first ever personal computers came out, and I took all that paper route money I'd saved and I went and bought one, and I learned how to program in it, and I was one of the very, very few. This is 1977. So this is Bill Gates' time. So I became one of those nerds. And I said to my father, I said, you're paying all this money to send me to this private school and all that. And I'm not going to go to college. I have no interest in that. I said, I've got an opportunity right now. Sitting in front of me is this keyboard and my ability to program it. Why don't you let me pursue that? And somehow he said yes. So at 15, I left school. I didn't finish high school. I just left. And I went out into the real world and I learned how jobs work and how commerce work and business. And then I started my own software company. By about, I guess, 8 years later, I was about 25. I sold it. I got out and I started traveling the world. And prior to that, because I was one of the very, very few people who knew how to program computers in that time, we put an ad in the yellow pages in the phone book. And next thing you know, I've got like the Attorney General's department calling me saying, we need you to write some software for this. And then the universities who I was supposed to go to, they'd be calling me going, we need someone to write software to manage our cryogenic freezer storage.
Wow.
Okay, whatever. So I do that. And then the forensic science labs in our state would call us. We did work for everybody, big corporations. And then the crazy one is I got asked to write this contract management and invoicing software system for this defense contractor. And they used my software to manage a $5 billion submarine contract for the Navy. So I'm like, I was 23 when that happened. So don't tell the Admiral, right? Whatever, it spits the invoices out and you get paid. What do you care?
Wow.
So yeah, it's a real pragmatic application of supply and demand, right? They somebody wanted something, I could do it. Let's do business. And that's the simplicity of that. I thought it was beautiful. It was so easy. So when I ended up coming to the United States when I was 24, I didn't, 25. I didn't realize that the entrenched systemic rule set that existed within the American ideology. Now, I'm an American citizen. I've lived here for nearly 30 years. So this is kind of normal now, but at the time it was alien. Like the whole idea that I couldn't get a job because some immigration guy said I didn't have the right card. All right, well, we'll go along with that. And eventually when I did get a green card and I was able to work, I'd sit in front of these job interviews, having done all this other stuff I mentioned. And I'd be sitting in I don't know, I think it was like McDonnell Douglas's office in Huntington Beach in California, and got a nice suit on, and they waltz out the HR guy and he go, yeah, I'm sorry, you can't work here. You haven't got a degree. What? Are you serious? I just wrote software that ran submarines. I guess you guys build defense stuff, right? You sure you can't use me on something? Nah, apparently not. Okay. And this happened like 20 times over. And then I stumbled into this little startup in Southern California that were, I always tell this story because it's exactly how it happened. They put out, they needed people. It's a medical company. They need a lot of people. So you'd go out to the site and they were still building their offices. So they had one of those like mobile trailers, mobile office trailers. So you'd go into this thing and, you know, you go down the back and there's the bosses down the back and you sit down. And I'd be on one side of the desk and her and her cohorts would be on the other. And they'd ask me all these questions. And I said, yeah, I can do that. No problem. I can do that. It's fine. And I'm thinking in my mind, they're just going to say no, right? Everyone else said, no, I don't have a degree. And I didn't realize, but on the other side of the desk, in her mind, she's going, he's going to say no. Nobody would want to work for a startup in a mobile office like this. Come on. And so when we realized our misunderstanding of each other, it was like click. And they offered me a job, and all of a sudden the world changed, and I became part of the American system. And, you know, I became a taxpayer and the whole bit. And they said at the time, oh, we're given these things called stock options out. And oh, I didn't know what a stock option was. I had no idea. So they give you 20,000 stock options, and you can, and they vest over like a 5-year period. So I'm like, okay, fine. 3-4 weeks later, they got approval by the FDA for their first drug, and that company became Amgen, the world's largest biotech company in the, you know, and I was one of the early guys with this big clump of stock options. So
nice. Wow.
Zero to hero, right? I'm glad I sat down on that chair. that was a good deal. But I was what, 25. What did I know? I didn't know squat, right? I'm more than double that age now. And so I look back on it and I go, oh, kid. because look, I didn't respect it because it was just given to me, right? I didn't have to work hard for it.
Yeah.
So what happened is that 5 years later, everything had vested and I get a phone call back from Australia. I was married. I got a phone call back from Australia that my mother had a car accident and I had to go home to see, you know, take care of it. So I jump on that plane and over we go again over the equator, and I get back to Australia, and she's really in bad shape. She's got onset dementia. Oh. Nobody knew.
Oh.
She couldn't drive. She was almost immobile. And yet when I left, she was like bright, sparkly, and totally independent.
Yeah,
but sad. I go back and it's like, that's gone. Mm. So I said to my wife, I got to move back. I've got to take care of my mom. And she goes, well, that's all right. I'll come. Oh, I would love to move to Australia. It sounds like, you know, Crocodile Dundee or something like that. Oh, fine. It's not really like that, but whatever. Sure. So she comes. We land, we set up, we buy a home, I quit my job, I got all this stock option money. I'm thinking I'm going to be fine. I'm 32. I never have to work another day in my life. I mean, who wouldn't want that, right? Well, it didn't work that way. 3 months or 4 months or so after we landed and bought a house and moved in and transitioned, my wife left me. I'm sure I was as responsible for these things as anybody, but I think what was the missing link here was a lack of hope. There was like, I was this kid with this passion and this energy and this ability to go and try and take on the world. And I had been pulled back, like lassoed back to where I came from.
Yeah.
And now I didn't have to work. So I sat around on the couch playing video games or whatever. And, you know, and it was in a future.
Right.
And people wanted me to be a future, right? And so that didn't work out. So when that happened, half the money went, which is normal. But now I've got this house I bought and just me living in it. So I decided I would mortgage that to pay her out for the half and I'd keep it. So then my money went even less. And eventually, I had a little bit left, but I was pretty depressed. I felt like I'd had my wings clipped and I was back there. And so some friends of mine said to me, do you want to come with us over the holiday period up to Queensland, which is like a 2-day drive up in the coast? And I said, sure, better than here. So we did this drive and we went up there, had New Year's Eve up in Queensland, and then we were coming back. And on the second day of driving, I was sitting in the back seat of the car. My buddy's driving, his girlfriend's in front in the passenger seat. And he, at high speed, hits a flash flood in the middle of the outback. And then the car lost control and went head on into a oncoming truck. Killed his girlfriend who was sitting in front of me, almost killed him. I was completely wrecked, half my body just destroyed from the impact, and they had to cut me out of the car and everything. And then put you in a coma, like one of those medical coma things.
Induced coma.
For about like a week, I think I was in that. And then they airlift us out from the outback back to the city, put us in one of these government hospitals, which was a joke. I feel like I was in like an episode of MASH. But, you know, I wasn't dead. I didn't lose the use of my fingers and I could still survive. I was fine. So I sort of thought to myself, well, could have gone way worse than this. So what are we going to do? Well, after about, I think, 4 or 5 weeks in hospital, they kicked me out because they needed the bed for the next victim. So I'm like barely can walk or anything. So I just decided that it was on me. And then I got this letter in the mail that said that they were no longer going to pay for any additional medical treatment because the parents of the girl who was killed in the car was blaming my buddy, the driver. It wasn't his fault. But they were so traumatized.
Right. Yeah.
They convinced the DA to file criminal negligent homicide on him. And the second a criminal case was pending, no one would pay anything for insurance, right? So at this point, now it's on me. So I had to fund everything. I had to fund all my rehabilitation, further surgeries, and then a lawyer to sue the government because they were the insurance company. To sue them to try to get them to pay it. And then a year later, they dropped the charges on my buddy and it would have been fine. But by now, it's like, I can't get that time back.
Right.
That's sort of critical in rehabilitation.
Oh, yeah.
So at this point, I'm just accepting the fact that I'm a disabled cripple now, and that's going to be the rest of my life. So I settled down and sort of tried to make the most of it. I ended up getting married again, and we had my wife, who's from Australia, we had a daughter. And then I guess it was about 1999, one of the guys I used to work with at Amgen calls me up and says, dude, get over here now. I'm like, why? He goes, well, there's this .com thing going on and we need you bad. So I'm like, well, does it pay? And he's like, yeah, sure, get on the plane. All right. So I come over back to Los Angeles, and it was like money just flying everywhere from this internet thing. So I got back to work and I called my wife up back in Australia. I said, listen, pack up the kid and yourself. Let's come over here and we'll start a life in California. So we did that. That was 99, I guess. By about 2005 or so, my wife's really, really smart at real estate. It's like in her blood. It took me longer to get it. I've always been the engaged action man, you know, kind of get stuff done. She's more, I don't know, holistic. She can see things. Mm-hmm. And she was the one who basically said we should be buying rental properties. And we were very lucky at the time because the exchange rate between Australia and the US was like, I think it was like the best of times I could get. It was 48 cents for a 48 US cents was one Australian dollar. Mm-hmm. So I could buy property at 50% off discount right off the bat. So we'd make our money in the US, buy these rental properties in Australia, rent them out, and just let them ride. You know, put a property manager there, just let them go. And we did that. Then we went back to work. By about 2005, we were millionaires again. And at that point, the real cool thing, and I try and explain this to younger people, because, you know, I get it. I know what it was like. They see these YouTube videos of guys who have made, you know, driving the Lambos, living the Insta life or whatever, and they're out there going, oh yeah, I got a GameStop or I bought, you know, this Dogecoin or something, and I'm out, you know, to the moon.
Yeah.
And they think that's how money works. Now realize that if you didn't earn it, you don't keep it. It's just sort of how things work, right? So anyway, I felt good about that second round because I felt like I earned it.
Yeah.
I felt like we took risks. It was on us.
Yeah.
And that felt good until 2008. So because what had happened was we had taken some of the winnings from that and bought property in we had moved to Arizona, mm-hmm. and we were buying property all through Phoenix, which was really good until the market crashed and wiped us out. But thankfully we had this international real estate diversification. So we sold these properties in Australia. We brought the cash over. We cleared out any dangerous levels of debt that we had in the States, and we still had a ton of cash. And then I bought up everybody's foreclosures. And I was Mr. Monopoly. I didn't want to buy a house or two. I bought a street, which is like multifamily units. I bought like 25 units. And that was fun because now my wife and I had to flip them to rent, and we've had them ever since. And I started realizing that we can live off of this rent. We never have to work another day in our lives. And I'm thinking, oh, that's what it was like when I was 32. I didn't end. So I might want to be a bit more careful about it this time. And just so happens that being in the tech industry, I got an early introduction to cryptocurrency back in 2011, and I bought a big swag of that and just held it, mm-hmm. and saw it go up from that either. So I got, that was lucky to some degree. That was lucky, maybe fortuitous, but lucky. The real estate was never lucky. That was prudent, basic, you know, slow money investing.
Yeah.
Now, you know, my wife and I are in our late 50s. I haven't had a job for, 20 years. I've enjoyed being free. I've done everything the opposite of everybody else. Like when everybody was saying, don't buy real estate in 2008, I went straight into the fire and bought everybody else's distressed assets.
Yeah.
And I started realizing if I did the polar opposite of everybody else, I got these monumental returns.
Right.
If I did what everyone else was telling me to do, I got nothing.
That's it. You can't follow the path, which the pack, right?
Well, I mean, I understand human nature, and I think I've learned more about the psychology over the years by immersing myself in the middle of things and working out, you know, how people are. Like, how do you handle conflict? How do you handle debate or, you know, alternative viewpoints? And how do you create a respectful environment where everyone feels included?
Yeah.
And how do you make sure that opportunities are evenly distributed, because that hurts me very much when coming in and being told no 20 times over on job interviews because I didn't have a degree. It wasn't the degree. It was the fact that the person on the other side of the desk who had done far, far less in life than what I had done was telling me that you don't get the opportunity. I'm not looking for a handout.
Right.
I'm looking for an opportunity. And if you just gave it to me, I could have made you better and me as well. It would have been a win-win. But the naivety of following this stupid mantra doesn't help them, doesn't help me, doesn't help anybody.
Right.
And that's, I guess, why my calling is to question it and call it out.
Yeah. So bring us up to today, Miles, and how does that desire to turn things on their heads and to question the social mantra, how does that manifest itself in your work today?
It got weirder. I've just closed on a big real estate acquisition in central Mexico. I bought a bullfighting ring.
Wow.
A complete compound. It's about an acre of land with these 30-foot high walls. And then inside, right in the middle, is a big bull. It used to be a matador school.
Wow.
So it was in a prime area of real estate, which I believe very strongly will have massive appreciation. But it's subdividable land. So the idea is we go in with a demo crew and we return it back to its natural land. It's got the most beautiful views I've ever seen, and subdivide out the parcel, and we'll keep the parcels we want, sell off the others. It's a zero cost acquisition. But it's an example of me going back to what saved us in 2008, and that was international diversification.
Yeah.
I have learned one thing, which is kind of a salient point, particularly for those who have hit the age of 50 and are looking beyond it. We have some really, unfortunately, sad and somewhat embarrassing statistics in the United States in regards to domestic economics, how much money people have. The starting point is to look at things like Forbes magazine's 2018 analysis that says that 78% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. I mean, that's unheard of. In the country that's the wealthiest in the world, to somebody who comes from the outside looking in, I'm going, what the heck? How did that happen? You've got all the money, but it seems like you don't spread it out. Well, fair enough. Okay, problem number one. You got problem number two. You've got people who did what their government told them to do, what their guidance counselors told them what to do, what their parents told them what to do. That is, you study hard, you stay in school, you get a degree, you go out, you get a good job, you work hard, you save, save, save. And when you're 65, you can go live in Florida or whatever. That's what we were told. It doesn't work. I mean, it flat doesn't work. And the statistics prove that the percentage of people who can afford at that age to retire, it's minimal. It's less than half. Yeah. I think it's close to about 38%. And what happens is people get depressed. They lose hope. They go, I'm going to end up having to work until the day I die. I'm going to be a greeter at Walmart or, you know, work in the aisle at Home Depot or something. I mean, that's not right. Well, as somebody who's run businesses before and consider myself to be reasonably economic in terms of financial independence and whatever, I will call that out because if you ask any business person, they'll tell you the one reason, particularly in small business, that they fail is not because they make a profit. It's because they don't have cash flow at the time they need it.
Right.
They can't make payroll. They can't pay their vendors. And for businesses that are seasonal, it's even more difficult.
Yeah.
Well, if you apply that exact same ideal on that exact same critical test point, for anybody's personal finance, you don't need to be somebody that Goldman Sachs says, oh, you know, you're a good person because you got $2 million in a, I don't know, an index fund somewhere. That's not going to make you safe in the future, right? What's going to make you safe is that you know what your burn rate is. That is how much it costs you to live.
Right.
And that you bring in every month an amount of money in excess of that. And I use 150% as my basic rule set for it.
Yeah.
So if I know it costs me, I don't know, $5,000 a month to live, I must make 7,500. Well, if you think that way, and you know that as you get older, your costs will deplete, because the kids have gone off and they've got their own life now, right? And you're not paying for their education, and eventually you pay your house off if you're lucky, or you downsize or whatever, but you get things a bit more manageable. All of a sudden you get that number down, what's less to have to get. So what I started to do with real estate was I realized, look, if I can own an asset that pays me to own it, all I need to do is get ahead of that burn rate. I never work another day in my life.
Right. Exactly.
And if the asset has its own momentum to do it, and real estate's great for this.
Yes.
Then all of a sudden, I let my tenants pay off a 15-year mortgage, own the thing freehold, do this at scale, and I'm bringing in 15 grand and I'm not getting out of bed. And here's the thing. That was kind of important in the last 2 years, right? Yeah, COVID, or you know, or you couldn't work. You need something that's going to pay you to own it.
Absolutely.
And I kind of look at this and go, well, why isn't this taught at school? That stop selling your time by the hour, right? You have one life. You have a finite number of hours. Why don't you just let the things you own pay for your burn rate? And no, you don't need to be driving around in a Ferrari. I mean, if you want to, fine, but don't put your own future at risk. And if you do this right, it will follow all the way through until the day you die, right? And then what happens is, if you've got kids, you've got something to give them. You give them the real estate, and you let them live off the real estate dividends so they can pursue their true purpose and find out what their passion is. And you encourage that. And then you've passed something down. And that, to me, I'm like one of these Maslow's hierarchy of needs kind of guys, yeah, right? Yeah. I'm on this like self-actualization path. So, you know, you go up the pyramid, and the idea is you get to the top and you can help everybody else, and throw a rope down and start pulling everyone else up.
Right.
Pull them out of poverty, pull them out of survival, pull them into purpose, and then eventually they take the mantle and you pass. And then, you know, that's kind of, I like that.
Yeah.
And I'm just sort of thinking, why? Well, we're doing everything wrong that goes against the human experience, everything. This, the worst part about it is that you got an 18-year-old kid who's been talking to the guidance counselor at high school, and the kid doesn't know what the hell they're going to be. I mean, they want to play football. They don't, you know, or maybe they're on the POM team or something. I don't know. But they don't know yet what their life will be. So what we do is we sit them down at the kitchen table at the age of 18. We put this big legal contract in front of them and say, sign at the bottom, kid, with the parents thumbs upping the whole thing. And that's your student loan debt. And you're going to go to college and you're going to take on 100K and you're going to pay this. Don't worry about that. What you're going to worry about is which college and what your college experience is going to be. And
it is. It's a big, it's really got completely out of hand. I've done a couple of shows recently on student loan debt and, you know, just the mess, just the big mess that it leaves people in. Starting your life out that way, it's just, it's a crime.
It's a crime imposed by the banking industry. And when you look at life overall, and you look at the reason why people can't retire, the reason why people don't have the freedom, or they're stuck on the job treadmill or whatever, it always comes back to the banks. It comes back to decisions you made maybe years ago to take on debt, buy things you couldn't afford, get that car to impress somebody you probably don't like anyway. I mean, all these things, you've got to pay them off. And The bank have a term, which we all know, called a mortgage. Do you know what the French translation of that is?
Death something, right?
Yeah, death contract. Death agreement.
Lovely.
if the banks know that, and it's been like that for hundreds of years, why aren't we waking up to the fact? I mean, we sit there, we just take it on. But everyone needs a roof over their head, right? So you just got to suck it up and put your money down and make your mortgage payments for 30 years. It doesn't work for me. Right. None of that makes any sense to me. And I question it. And that's why I guess I'm a contrarian.
But it's good though. You know, I mean, you were saying before we started recording that because you aren't from here, that you feel like you had a different, that you viewed things slightly differently. You weren't just raised with these ideas. This is what you do. You're going to go to college. You're going to take on all this debt, and then you're going to get a house and add to your debt. And then you're going to do these other things that you looked at it with logic, with a different slant. And, you know, it just didn't make a lot of sense. Yeah.
That's why corporations hire consultants, because the consultant comes in with a different viewpoint and imparts that to the company, and hopefully they take something on board and they adjust accordingly. And I'm kind of like an outsider living on the inside to some degree. But there's so many things that are just disconnects with how people in other countries, and I can only really speak for Australia, but I think it applies in Europe as well, that the idea that 18-year-old kid should not be signing anything. He should get a backpack and give him a ticket to fly around the world for a couple of years, get him to learn how to be a bartender in Tokyo if he has to, but just go out there and find yourself in a world of adverse challenges where you don't speak the language, and it's on you to work this out. Because after you've had that, you come back, and then everything they throw at you, it doesn't make sense anymore. It really doesn't. I mean, a lot of people who've done that, right? Do you travel?
Oh, I travel a lot. Yeah.
Okay. So when you come back, do you get that sort of that epiphany, that moment where you say, I know that's how I used to do that all the time. Yeah. But that's stupid.
Yeah. It forces you to look at yourself and your life differently. It definitely does.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I read something once that said something like, warning, travel may be dangerous to small minds, or something like that.
It's good. You don't take yourself as seriously for a start, right? Because you've got to check your ego at the door when you don't speak German and it's 11 o'clock at night and somehow you've got to buy some food because you're starving at the bar.
The first time I went to Germany, I was with a vegetarian, and we're like looking at the menu like, I have no clue. And we're trying to explain to the waitress that he didn't want to eat meat. And she just was like, that concept, this was, you know, 20 years ago. She's like, what the hell are you talking about? No meat? Oh, you're kidding. So I don't even remember what he just ended up with, like a big plate of broccoli or something.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, I find this stuff exciting. I find this stuff challenging. It breaks me out of any rut. It refreshes my batteries. And I realize why people, when they retire, the first thing they try and do is travel. But I feel so sorry for somebody who went out to the age of, say, 65 and then retired, because you're going to travel with that bad hip and the bad knee and you know, your bad back. You're going to put yourself on a plane compressed in while you go to Thailand or whatever, and all of a sudden it's like you come out the other guy and you're going, oh, I'm not cut out for this. And you realize, oh my God, I've got to walk everywhere. You know, I used to have a Fitbit and I'm trying to get 10,000 steps every day. And now I'm in London and it cost me 22,000 steps to get to the British Museum. I mean, right? You can't do this stuff at 65. Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it, you need to get yourself retired early.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about some fire movement thing. I'm talking about work out, get your burn rate under control.
Yes.
Get something that makes you money where you don't have to expend your labor to do it, and you get your time back. And then all of a sudden you can go and spend 3 months in Prague or whatever.
Right.
You can learn to play the piano or whatever you want to do. I don't know.
Right.
At least you get a shot at it.
No, you're so right. But that is the key, is the burn rate, right? I mean, if you are just thinking, oh, I've got to have that car and that suit and that house and that this and that and the other thing, then you're never going to be able to achieve it. You know, you want to say, these are the things I want. So what can I buy today that's going to create the income that'll give me those things, instead of just buying them first? Everything's out of order, you know? No, 100%. It all comes down to how much does it cost you every single month to live your life?
It's often very hard to, I'm glad you see it that way, because it's exactly what I'm trying to say. But it's very hard to confront somebody and say, you did it all wrong. You're a loser. Why the hell did you go to that college? Why'd you buy that car? What, you know, I don't want to come across like I'm, you know, some arrogant idiot. But at the same time, I just sort of think, man, if I could have spoken to you when you were 25, right? If I could have just said, before you do that, consider the real cost, right? And maybe just walk away for a week and just take some time to make a decision. Don't jump in all these things on some because so-and-so did it, or you've got this fear of missing out, like that you can own your decisions, and that you're willing to, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. Yeah, it is. It's like that. But it's okay. It's okay. Just be careful what you decide. That doesn't mean don't do anything, because you'll be bored out of your skull if you do that. No, you got to do something. Just be responsible and be pragmatic. And I know it's not sexy and it's not on some billboard, you know, you're going to have the American Express Platinum card or whatever. No, I'm not up on the billboard telling you stop buying crap. I'm not going to do that. I just want people to understand there are costs that go on for decades. And God forbid you get to a point in life where all you're doing is living in regret all the time. That'll eat you up. That'll kill you.
Yeah, it's so true. So Miles, let's get to the place where we can sort of give people some advice, and maybe something that even could, you know, if you're not 25 anymore and you did already take on some student loan debt or something, and what can people do? Is it just sort of hopeless?
No. Well, the first thing I would do is, if you're committed to try to get control of your freedom of your life back so that you can retire and you have choices, what you want to do, what I've told people, what's worked for me, is I compartmentalize a lot of things that are going on in my expenses. So let's say, for example, food. Well, if you have a budget for your family of, I don't know, $500, $600 a month for food or whatever, try and find really creative ways to break that down so that you can grow your own if you can, barter for it, work out how coupons work, and get it down. But let's just say you can get it down to 60% of that. All right, that's one thing. Take the extra money you were normally going to spend at the supermarket and put it towards an income generating asset. Look, you're not going to buy you might put a down payment on a property, a couple hundred bucks. But what you could do is buy some dividend stocks that pay you to own them, not growth stocks. You know, get some REITs or some dividend stocks that pay you to have them. And if that is happening every month, well, a year of that, you got $2,400 buying you stocks. And what will happen, and it takes time, but that's okay. You know, we've got that. Over time, what happens is you build up like a portfolio of these things. And then at a certain point, you start seeing them paying you back. And all of a sudden, $100 a month comes in, $200 comes in. And you're going, hang on. If I got my food down to say $300, let's say, all I need to do is get $300 and now I never have to pay for food ever again. Oh, right. Let's do that. Okay. Let's rinse and repeat that. Okay. I need to pay for my power bill. How am I going to do that? Well, I could go and buy solar panels or whatever, maybe. Well, how about this idea? Go on eBay and buy a used vending machine and then make a deal with the local tire company or something that you could put it in their waiting room and you'll share the profits with the owner. You know, you need to give them like 20%. But when you go down to Sam's Club or Costco or whatever, and you buy like a couple of dozen cans of soda, the cost per can is probably about 30, 40 cents, something like that. You put them in that machine and you're selling them for $2.50. That's a heck of a margin that you can afford to lose 20% on. If you do that, and then once a week, let's say you did it with five locations, and you do this once a week because you can do this at scale, you can organize yourself systematically for probably less than half a day of work, and I would say probably every 2 weeks maybe, where you buy stock and then you visit your machines, replenish them, pull out the coins and the money and then go to the bank or whatever. If that takes you half a day every 2 weeks, but you're pulling maybe $1,000 a month of profit off that, now you can compartmentalize another expense. And if you just keep doing this, because it's not taking you any time to get your dividend stocks, and it's not taking you much to do the vending machines, then you can start to accelerate this out. Eventually, if you saved up enough money, you buy your first rental property. You let the tenants pay it off. You don't. So you just do that. And as the thing goes up, and eventually they always do, you strip out a bit of equity with a refi, you go and buy another one. Now you've got two going up, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't take long to get yourself 100% self-sufficient. If you can't do it, my God, I did it in 4 years, right? If you can't do it in 5 or 6, you don't want to do it. That's the answer. And so anybody who say hit the age of 50 and they're looking at, you know, how can I afford to retire? All you got to do is meet your burn rate, right? And if you do it, here's the other thing which people misunderstand. When they say retire, they don't get it. So I'll tell you a story. My father died at the age of 67. He retired at the age of 65. So one would say, well, he had a wonderful 2-year retirement. The unfortunate reality was he worked for a company that made building materials that were made of asbestos. So when he retired with lung cancer. So that's what killed him. I had to bury him. I was 22 years old when it happened. And when a kid, I call myself a kid at that age, when a kid has to ID the body and the whole bit, you get this kind of there but for the grace of God go I idea. And I looked at it and I'm like, Dad, I love you, but I'm not going to do what you did. I'm not. I won't sell myself out for to be the company man and loyal to the team. And if this is how it ends up, well, it's interesting when I was over here, because I had a bit of experience when I first arrived in defense and working in that area. I was talking with some people who worked up at Boeing Corporation, and I found out that I think the BBC got hold of some internal documents from the HR department at Boeing. Boeing used to have a pension program for their workers, and they work out per employee how much money do they have to, you know, save because they've got to pay out pension. They worked out if you worked at Boeing until the age of 55, the average life expectancy was 83, I think. So that gave them the number they had to target their funding. Well, they accelerated that number and they worked out people who retired at the age of 65, how much did they need for them? And what came back was shocking. Statistically, they found out the average life expectancy from a 65-year-old retirement was 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah. But nobody wanted this information to go public because it destroys the entire personal financial advising industry. It destroys 401ks and IRAs and this, because nobody's going to participate on it if that's what they think their payoff is.
Right.
So I was speaking at an event in Phoenix pre-COVID, and it was a small event. And this lady, after I'd done my speech, this lady came up to the podium and we were just talking. She says, oh, you love your speech, whatever. She goes, I was interested to hear what about the Boeing study. And I thought, yeah. I thought, okay, here's someone's going to chew me out because she probably has worked for an investment bank and, you know, doesn't want me talking about this. She goes, well, I'm a CFO, or just retired, but I used to be a CFO at Honeywell, which here in Phoenix, big defense contractor. She said, we did the exact same study as Boeing for our employees, and we got the identical same result.
Wow.
So when I heard that, I'm like, right, okay. So I've been really interested in looking at life expectancy numbers. And what I found was even more shocking. The CDC, who we know and love because of the COVID and the vax, well, the CDC have always published life expectancy numbers for average by US male, US female, and so on. And their numbers, I've only been looking at their numbers since about 2016. But in 2016, their numbers showed that the average US male life expectancy was 79.3 years. Now, that is lower than most Western European countries, lower than Canada, and it's lower than a lot of Latin American countries too, which is surprising. But you could call that out for like the opioid crisis, obesity, that sort of thing. This is what contributes. Bad food, all that stuff. Well, they did the same study going forward year after year, and I was tracking it. Let's say 2019, because one has to be relatively pre-COVID with this, because COVID skews things.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2019... that number had dropped to 76.5 years.
Wow. In 3 years' time. So
in 3 years, wow. It dropped 3 years. that scares me because we have a government telling us to keep working until you're 67. You know, like, let's raise the retirement age, but the life expectancy is dropping. Why the hell would you do that?
Because they have to pay Social Security. They saw the Boeing study too.
So this data doesn't get out, and people look. If anybody's questioning, oh, Miles, you got it wrong. You do the research. Go on there and you do the research. You will find the exact same data that I find. I openly welcome people to do that, because if they walk away going, holy crap, I don't have that much time to live, maybe they'll get busy having a life.
Right. Exactly.
They won't be sitting on their smartphone all day. They'll be out there, you know, climbing Machu Picchu or something. I don't know.
Miles, I wish we had more time to talk. I want to be respectful of your time, but I really quickly just want to thank you, because one of the things that you said that I think is so critical, I mean, you said a lot of awesome things, but when you were talking about compartmentalizing, because it's so easy for us to say, oh, it's only $6 for coffee. Well, you know, what's difference is $6 going to make? What difference is it going to make that I bought, you know, $25 worth of stupid Halloween decorations? And what difference is this $50 going to make? But by taking it, saying, no, your goal is not to like save $3 million to retire. It's just, you only need to save enough to create a passive income that's going to pay this one bill. Just pay your electric bill, right? Just pay that. I mean, that's brilliant. I really love that. And I think that's something that people can kind of get their brains around.
Yeah. I mean, it's what, how to eat an elephant, right? One bite at a time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent.
That's all you can do. You're just going to do it. And it's fine. And guess what? maybe you'll save a couple of bucks in the first week you do it. And you'll go, oh, I've got a couple of extra bucks here. That's pretty cool. I don't feel so stressed. If the car breaks down, maybe I can afford to fix it now. I mean, yeah, come on. It doesn't take that much. But it's just a question of deferring that wonderful fast food, you know, attitude we have to everything. And, you know, instant gratification ain't all it's cracked up to be.
It's so true. It's so true. I'm going for the long term, you know, eternal satisfaction, eternal gratification.
Sure, for sure.
So, Miles, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, listener, for listening. I'm really excited. And I want to thank my listeners again, because my goal for the year was to get up to 50 countries. We're already in almost 40 countries. So we're so close. We still have a month to go, month and a half to go. So keep on sharing with folks in other countries. Be sure to be here next week. We'll have lots of other fun people to share with you, and make sure that you share this episode with someone, because Miles could potentially change the friend who you forward this to. Miles could potentially change their lives.
Yeah. If anybody is interested, they can find out more about all the ramblings that I do over at our website, which is beunconstrained.com. If they go there, they'll get more of me if they want to put up with me.
So beunconstrained.com, and we'll also, of course, put those into the show notes, you know, all the ways to contact Miles and into the show notes, so that you can just click there and find his website if you happen to be driving and you can't take that down.